Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. And this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, as we arrive in the 1970s, the Vietnam War is still going strong, though now most Americans have turned against the war, and the main effort of the U.S. government by this time is mostly just trying to find a way out. How did this fact impact Navy planning, policy, and morale?
Well, it was central to all of those. You know, we talk about decades in round numbers, which makes sense certainly for our broadcaster, but in a way, I think we can think about the 60s as that term has come to have a particular meaning in popular culture, really overlaps. I mean, the 60s kind of begin in 1964 and run through about 1974. So really, many of those issues and problems that we associate with the 60s were still very much endemic in the early years of the 1970s. They were very difficult days for the United States military generally, including for the Navy. We're all aware that today there's a tendency, thank goodness, for Americans to appreciate the military. There's salutes at sporting events, spontaneous applause occasionally when troops are spotted on aircraft. But in the early 1970s, it was very different. Uniformed personnel were more likely to receive dirty looks and even occasional name-calling. And that came out of the sense of frustration and anger at the Vietnam War and spilled over onto the individuals who were charged with fighting that war. So morale was pretty bad in the early 1970s. The Vietnam War was so unpopular that Richard Nixon had been elected on the promise of ending it and was doing anything he could, nearly desperate to find a way out. And the solution he came up with, such as it was what he called Vietnamization. And that is to say he would keep the war going long enough for us to get our troops out. And then after that, well, that then would not be our problem. So withdrawals had begun by 1970. The first troops actually came out in 1969. The Marines were out entirely by 1971. The first POWs were released in 1971, but all this time negotiations were continuing, and the government began to behave almost as if the war were already over. There were huge cuts in defense. There was a deactivation of more than 100 warships in 1971. But the war was still going on, particularly the air war, bombing. The North was being bombed by the United States, largely in order to maintain pressure on the negotiators in Paris. But the Paris Peace Accords were finally signed in 1973, and the United States left that tragic nightmare behind, and most Americans were glad of it. So not a happy time in the first 3-4 years of the decade, the winding down of the Vietnam War. But that was certainly the dominant issue of those first few years.
And as a nation as a whole, and of course our Navy and Marine Corps simply reflects its nation, but the social changes that started to gain momentum in the last part of the 1960s continued to gain steam in the 1970s, especially the civil rights movement in many areas where it was continuing to branch out in different ways. Were there any further ramifications in the Navy than what we saw in the late 60s?
Oh, well, sure. That process did not end. either with the changing of the decade or even with the end of the Vietnam War. I guess individuals would argue that they're still in process today. History is a constant story of change. Race was certainly an issue in the country at large and within the military services, including the Navy. We mentioned briefly last time the racial confrontations that took place on a couple of American aircraft carriers, the Kitty Hawk and the Constellation, in 1971-72. But on the other side of that coin, too, there were new opportunities being opened to African Americans in the Navy, specialties that had previously not been restricted, but certainly by tradition limited to those, to whites mostly. But in 1971 as well, the United States Navy got its first black admiral. Sam Gravely became a rear admiral in 1971. Later that same year, the Navy appointed the first woman admiral, the head of the nurse corps, Aileen Duerk. So there's some changes taking place in that respect. I think the biggest change for the Navy certainly was the administration of the Chief of Naval Personnel, Elmo Zumwalt, Bud Zumwalt as he was known, appointed in 1970 while the Paris Peace Accords were going on, while Nixon was trying to find a way out of Vietnam. And I think Nixon made that choice, reaching past a large number of admirals much senior to Zumwalt to choose this relatively young man, not only because he had been successful in the field as the commander of Naval Forces Vietnam, but because he was clearly a representative of the front edge of some of those social changes. And I think the expectation was, and that expectation was fulfilled, that Zumwalt would be a vehicle for this transitional period. And the way he went about that was by issuing these OPNAV messages, all Navy messages that he numbered sequentially from 1 up to 100 and something, that dealt with, these are essentially executive orders, if you would. This is not something, no policy issue, no committee worked on these things particularly, or if they did, it was on, over Zumwalt's name that these changes came out. And many of them dealt with relatively small things, issues of liberty or whether junior officers could have sideburns below the top of their ear and then could they go to the bottom of their ear. They seemed relatively mundane both then and frankly still now. But many of them were also quite important. I know that one dealt specifically with racial discrimination, with requiring the services to open specialties within the service to African Americans where they had previously not played a role. Obviously, in the early part of the 20th century, Filipinos and African Americans were just expected to be stewards. That was the rating to which for which they would strike. Well, now, you know, aviation, mechanic, and electronic, I mean, all of the specialties, and by order. In December of 1970, he issued a Z-gram dealing with that, and a year or two later, he did another one on roles for women, how there were going to be new opportunities for women. So I think these Z-grams and Zumwalt generally represented a kind of revolution, a social revolution within the Navy that the traditions of certainly the pre-World War II Navy and even the World War II and immediate post-years Navy were now going to change, and they did change. That was probably essential to Nixon's decision in 1973 to end the draft. You know, you get rid of the draft. A lot of the Navy was always volunteer, but many people went into the Navy to avoid being selected by the Army. I mean, who wouldn't pick the Navy over the Army, right? So the end of the draft in 1973 meant that now the Navy had to compete even harder for the qualified personnel it needed to man its fleet. That's the same year the war ended, 1973. The same year the War Powers Act was passed that now said the president must get congressional approval within 60 days or he can't send troops overseas. So 1973 is a kind of a milestone year in a lot of ways. The end of the draft, the implementation of the Z-grams, the end of the Vietnam War, all of those things. So, the social changes continued certainly through the end of the Vietnam War and actually several years beyond it.
Earlier you mentioned about the large block decommissioning we saw in 1971, but there were a lot of force structure changes that were taking place towards the tail end of our involvement in the Vietnam War and really through the decade. Did the Navy change as a result of his experience in Vietnam on what type of ships and equipment it desired and needed?
It did, but in a way, I think you could argue that it reverted to the primary goals that the Navy had been charged to fulfill in the years prior to the Vietnam involvement. Now, obviously now, after 1974, there's less demand for things like swift boats and river monitors and so forth, and many of those were turned over to the South Vietnamese Navy anyway, and frankly lost most of them within a year to North Vietnam. But I think three general developments reemerge, not so much emerge as reemerge. One is the continued development of the deterrence mission. You know, ever since the Soviet Union demonstrated its capability of deploying a nuclear weapon in 1949, the United States maintained a deterrence, that is, a credible capability of striking so heavily at the Soviet Union that it would not be tempted to launch a nuclear war. And a large part of that was our submersible fleet, the submarine fleet that fired the Polaris missile. Well, the Polaris was replaced by the Poseidon in 1972, just as the Vietnam War was winding down. It's a bigger, larger missile with a heavier payload, and perhaps most important of all, that payload could now include multiple independently targetable vehicles. MIRV was the acronym that was used at the time, so that one missile could now deploy as many as 14 warheads at various sites, independently targetable warheads. So that dramatically increased the second response capability that the Navy could deploy and enhance very much the deterrence mission. And then, of course, by the end of the decade, the Trident missile, the third generation, if you would, of those submarine launch missiles is deployed in, I think, in 1979, so toward the end of the war. So that's one, is the deterrence mission. Another is the return to the Navy's role in sea control. And I think the principal vehicle for that was the Spruance-class destroyers. They were the workhorses of the fleet from 1970, mid-decade, 1975 or so, up through the 1990s. The Spruance-class, gas turbine-driven, primarily an ASW platform, anti-submarine warfare, but really used in widely throughout the fleet for the next several decades. So the Spruance-class destroyers, not really a new weapons platform, but a new generation of destroyers that joined the fleet in the 1970s. And then finally, a change that lasted up right until the present day, and that is, of course, the increasing importance of the missile over the gun as the dominant deployable weapon platform. In that, I guess, the Tomahawk missile, which came out in the 1970s, I think the first test firing was in 76, and they were deployed to the fleet in 1978, and are still there. So this is an important change in development technologically. The Perry-class guided missile frigates carried many of them. And just as an aside, let me make this note, that if you look at the history of the Navy over a broader scale than we've been doing decade by decade, the distance at which ordnance is, you know, implemented changes so dramatically. In the age of sail, the United States was a new country. Ships of the sail had to get within 80 to 100 yards. Visually, you know, you could almost literally see the whites of their eyes before those smoothbore cannon had an effective range. In the age of steam, maybe 800 yards. By the age of the battleship, 15, 20 miles. The age of the carriers, now you could send ordnance out 150, maybe 200 miles in an extreme use of carriers by the end of World War II. But now in the missile age, that range extends to 1,500 or 1,800 miles. So the range at which ordnance is being deployed has grown so dramatically that it's over the horizon, beyond visual sighting, which requires all sorts of technological photography and satellites and all sorts of things to keep track of it. So the implementation of missiles on board Navy ships in the 1970s is really a very dramatic change.
And though we've talked about obviously the Vietnam War that is a big part of the 1970s, and we're talking the larger strategic and core issues, but there were other crises in the world where the Navy Marine Corps team got the call to go get involved in. What were those other areas?
Well, there were some, but it's interesting that the attitude, I think, in the public generally, and therefore recognized and acted upon by political leaders, was that Americans didn't want to have any more or very many more of these overseas adventures. So that kind of slowed down quite a bit after 1974. There were a few, of course, in mid-decade, 74, 75, the United States was a major player in clearing the Suez Canal of mines that had been left behind by Mideast wars. There was the Mayaguez incident in 1975, if no one recalls that. The Mayaguez was a container ship, American-registered, American ship, that was boarded and captured by Cambodian naval forces in 1974, 75, I think it was 75. The Ford administration, Gerald Ford administration, responded swiftly to that, recapturing the ship, gaining a release of the prisoners. It was kind of a feel-good moment to show that we weren't the hapless folks we appeared to be in our conduct of the Vietnam War. But the biggest one and the most important one overseas, I think, came at the very end of the decade, and that is the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979. The Iranian government deposed the reigning Shah that had been foisted upon them, quite frankly, by the West. British, French, and American involvement kind of just put him in as our boy. The revolution that deposed him blamed the West for that. When President Carter allowed the Shah, by now suffering from cancer, admission to the United States to get medical treatment, that was perceived by the Iranians as them rescuing this war criminal, in their view, from prosecution. And they were so angry at the United States, this crowd of students, supposedly egged on no doubt by others as well, but supposedly a student mob outside the U.S. Embassy, took over the embassy and held the American attached to that embassy, including a number of Marines, for an interminable 444 days. And that led to great frustration and anger on the part of Americans. We could not believe that the strongest power in the world could not overcome a bunch of bearded, long-haired students. Why can't we release those prisoners? And it was even more frustrating when Operation Eagle Claw, as it was called, a joint operation of Army, Navy, Air Force personnel attempting to rescue the hostages in Tehran, bogged down in the middle of the desert, and it had to be called off. So that was an unhappy moment in not so much Navy history, but American military history generally. It did have a consequence, and we can talk about this later, in the development of joint rapid deployment forces, including SEAL Team 6 and the Rangers and others, into the subsequent decades. But it was a very unhappy moment at the time in 1979 and seemed to confirm the idea that overseas adventures were just not a very good idea. They could get you in a lot of trouble, which is not entirely untrue. But certainly that hostage crisis in 1979 sealed the political fate of President Carter, who was hurled out of office, I think, on the wave of American unhappiness with his inability to resolve that crisis in 1979.
And there we come to the end of the Hairy Navy decade and bringing things into a little more modern context. I look forward to next time, Craig, when we dip into the Reagan era.
Happy to do it.
Claude, when we look at the 1970s, we look at a decade that's bookended by two great events. That was the winding down of the American involvement in Vietnam at the beginning of the decade, and then towards the end of the decade, an event that really set the table for the following 30 years plus. That was the aborted rescue attempt of the American hostages who were being held in Iran. The 1970s, not only for our Navy, with, as Craig mentioned during our discussion, we had that huge decommissioning that took place early in the decade. It was a tough decade for our Navy, but also for our nation in general. And my dad would often recall the 1970s were a decade that he would rather forget. And as we kicked off that decade, what sometimes people refer to as the Hairy Navy, and we'll talk about one of the guys that helped bring the Hairy Navy to us later on. But in 1970, what do we start to see written in our proceedings and other Naval Institute journals?
Well, certainly at the forefront in 1970 was the Vietnam War. You had articles on by Commander Shreedley on the life and challenges of the brown water sailor in Vietnam. You had the Secretary of the Navy, John Chafee, who later becomes a senator in the United States Senator, who writes an article on POW treatment, principles versus propaganda, in which he offered very harsh criticism of the North Vietnamese for their really wretched treatment of U.S. prisoners of war. So that's really what kicks off the 1970s, if you will. Also in May of 1970, for the very first time, Proceedings has a new naval review that appears in the May issue of Proceedings, some 600 pages total, with major essays, maritime sections, photos, and names of all the flag officers of the naval services, and that's a tradition that continues to this day. There are smaller issues, I shouldn't say smaller issues, but issues that aren't addressed as much during the 1970s as one major issue, which I think we'll probably discuss in a few minutes. You have Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Now, this is the first time he's Secretary of Defense. Pardon me, this is just after he's Secretary of Defense for the first time, in which he's criticizing the five-year shipbuilding program. And he says that you've got to get it right, and that if you make mistakes, that they would last for decades to come. And I think we've seen that. This came shortly after an article by Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, the Chief of Naval Operations, on high-low, on his candid assessments of certain high-low ships and their weapon systems. You had Admiral Isaac Kidd Jr. writing in 1975 about cost overruns for procurement, contractor claims. So these are issues that we will see time and again. And it's about the same time that Kidd also writes another article on the Naval Material Command supplies, supplying everything but people. That there are shipbuilding problems. He's explaining what the Navy's doing, what the DOD has agreed to do, and what the Congress should be asked to do. So again, these are not new situations, but what is interesting is the debates that they're having about shipbuilding and contracting and high-low ships have a legacy through the 2000s, because you have to keep in mind that the Aegis shipbuilding program, for example, really came into fruition in the 1970s. It had been begun in the late 1960s with the Ticonderoga class. So those ships by the 1980s are well into the fleet. So we're starting to see what we are familiar with today and that Navy. You have other smaller issue articles, but from noted people that we would know today. You had a Captain James Webb, United States Marine Corps. James Webb obviously would become Secretary of the Navy under Reagan for a time. He became a United States Senator in Virginia until recently, and this year was running as a Democrat for President of the United States before he left the race. But his article in 1972 was on Turmoil in Paradise, Micronesia at the Crossroad, in which he suggested that Americans' disinterest with Micronesia would result in a terrible price. If we weren't careful, it would revert to Japanese control. You had another Marine Corps officer, Major Robert McFarlane, who wrote in 1971, At Sea Where We Belong, in which he suggests that we needed to invest in assault shipping that was necessary to keep two Marine amphibious brigades afloat at all times. He wrote an article later that decade in 79 on the political potential of parity, where he suggests that it was time to take the USSR seriously as a nuclear threat, and that it was no longer in a position of nuclear inferiority. And of course, Bud McFarland goes on to become the national security advisor to President Ronald Reagan. So we're starting to see these names appear in the 70s, Webb, McFarland, Rumsfeld, and others, who would really play a role in the 1980s, 1990s, and to some degree until today.
Over at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum for the 1970s, what type of exhibit items would people find that will represent that time period?
Well, for the Warrior Writer exhibit that we have until January 31st of 2016, we have a few books out. Robert McFarlane loaned us one of his books. That's in one of the cases. We have a painting of Elmo Zumwalt. We have a painting of the former chief of naval operations at that time, Arleigh Burke, with one of his quotes. In the museum proper, it's focused primarily on the Vietnam War as well as the development of the nuclear navy. We have models of ships such as the Ticonderoga class. We've got several submarines. We've got a number of items from Vietnam, particularly with regard to prisoners of war. I mentioned earlier that Secretary of the Navy John Chafee had written that article, very critical treatment of the POW. So we have a bracelet that was worn that was very popular at the time of individuals wearing a bracelet with the name of a prisoner of war. Keep in mind that there were a lot of prisoners of war who were Naval Academy graduates. Certainly John McCain was one of the more famous one of the most famous ones. James Stockdale, so many others that came out of the Academy. Bill Lawrence, later Admiral Bill Lawrence, who became superintendent of the Naval Academy. We have some examples of sandals that they wore that had been tires that the North Vietnamese had refabricated. What's interesting, we also have a cigarette packet. And a couple of years ago, I was interviewed by a Vietnamese documentarian, and his translator and I were walking around the museum and showing them a few things that we had. They were interviewing me because of a couple of articles I had written on how the United States, specifically the Office of Strategic Services in 1945, had sent in a team of seven individuals to train about 80 North Vietnamese guerrilla fighters at the time to work against Japan. And these included Ho Chi Minh and later and Giap as well. So we basically trained these individuals. So they were asking me about the items we had for the Vietnam exhibit. And it was kind of funny because they looked at the cigarettes and they said, oh, we only gave the best cigarettes to the prisoners. And I sort of turned to her and I said, I don't think that's the story we've received from the prisoners of war who returned. I think they would have a very different perspective on that. And we also have a number of items from Admiral Rickover. He was in his last full decade in the 1970s. He wouldn't retire until the 1980s. But a number of his items in the museum as well.
In that Vietnam era, the 70s, you had the two bold-faced items there. There was the U.S. exit in 72, and then just a few years later in 1975, with the North Vietnamese invasion of the South and the subsequent fall of Saigon. What type of writing at the period did we start to see of the reflection of the Vietnam experience, or did it have to wait till later in the decade before people would start looking back at that 72 to 75 time period?
I think it was still too early at that time. We start to see more of them in the 1980s as they begin to reflect. Really, the biggest topic that existed in the 1970s was about the Soviet Union. That was the threat to the United States Navy. We were pulling out of Vietnam, and even while we were in Vietnam, we were dealing with the Soviets elsewhere in the world. So you have experts like Captain Sumner Shapiro, who later becomes an admiral of the Office of Naval Intelligence. He was a career Soviet specialist intelligence officer who was reporting on the new professionalism of officers in the Soviet Navy. On the Blue Water Soviet naval officer, and he writes that very early on in the decade in 1971. The prize essay for that year was by Captain Robert Smith, which he called for a United States Navy for the future. He suggested that the Soviet Navy presented a major challenge. The U.S. Navy had to wake up and get going, get better leadership, get better classes of new ships, and know what we needed and stand up for it in a very clear way. I think, however, the most intriguing series came around 1974 or so with translations of Admiral of the Fleet of the Soviet Union, Sergei Gorshkov. Gorshkov had written 11 articles for the Soviet journal Morskoy Sbornik. Morskoy Sbornik was essentially the proceedings equivalent in the Soviet Union, and it had a really a history going back to, I think, the 1840s and a previous incarnation. This was something that was for the officers, the naval schools, reserve officers, and other people interested in naval affairs, just as proceedings is. So Gorshkov's articles are published in Morskoy Sbornik in 72 and 73, and then they're republished and translated in 74, each with a commentary by a U.S. officer. So it's interesting to see the perspective that the U.S. Navy had on the leader of the Soviet Navy and what he was saying. And I think this is very important as well, because if you want to know where a Navy is going, you listen very carefully to what their leadership is saying. I think that's why chiefs of naval operations, secretaries of the Navy, are very careful about the words that they speak in any type of environment, because the other countries will be listening for any hints on what may or may not happen, any trends that may be developing, etc.
And finally, you kind of hinted on it early on when you brought up Aegis, but as in many decades, we've talked about this during the course of the series, those decades where you find our Navy under a lot of stress, under a lot of change, you can really start to see certain inflection points. And one of those in the 1970s was right at mid-decade when it came to cruisers, the big part of the naval fleet. We saw in 1975 the decommissioning of the USS Newport News, CA-148. That was the last of the all-gun cruisers. And we also saw in mid-decade between 75 and 78 two things. You had the high water mark of the nuclear surface fleet, pre Three Mile Island and pre everybody appreciating how expensive they were to run. That, right, of course, was the Virginia, the Texas, the Mississippi, and the Arkansas. And then starting to cast a shadow on what was going to be Pierside in the last part of the century was the development of Aegis. That little microcosm of the mid-decade, those big inflection point in the development of cruisers and their use in our Navy. Where can we find items in that particular subject area over at the museum?
Well, I want to go back to that for just a second, because as you're starting that drawdown in the 1970s and the threat of the Soviet Union, it's not like they're not looking at other threats or issues that can't be employed against the Soviets. For example, in 1978, a couple of proceedings authors wrote an article on microcomputers in the Navy and the prospects that were truly exciting for microcomputers, particularly shipboard. But you also had other issues they were looking at. In September of 1979, for example, a U.S. Coast Guard officer, Lieutenant Commander John Ebersol, writes an article, International Terrorism and the Defense of Offshore Facilities, in which he suggested that oil rigs would soon prove too tempting a target for terrorists to ignore. And I think this was the very first article I found in Proceedings with regard to terrorism. And you'll recall we're both of that age, where we remember the storming of the Iranian embassy in 1979, the taking of the American hostages, and really ushering in an era of terrorism against the United States that continues, unfortunately, until this day. But this is when they've really first start looking at terrorism. But with regard to the Aegis, I think you asked specifically about what we might find in the museum about Aegis. We would have primarily models of the Ticonderoga and Arleigh class ships, the cruisers and the destroyers. In fact, we're building a model right now. We have a curator of ship models, who is the only congressionally authorized position in the Naval Academy Museum, a position that goes back to 1939, and we've only had four of them. He is currently building the USS Thomas Hudner, DDG-116, and the real ship is being constructed at Bath as we speak, at Bath Iron Works in Maine. He is building this model that's going to be displayed in our lobby probably in about 4 or 5 months. And it was done at the request of Thomas Hudner's classmates. Thomas Hudner was a Medal of Honor recipient, and the class of 1947 asked us to, or commissioned us to, build that very large model so that our midshipmen today can really see the development of ships over the past not only 40, 50 years, but over the past century or so.
And with that, we will bring the decade to a close, Claude, and I look forward to going over the Reagan-era Navy with you at our next time with the 1980s.
Thank you very much.